The Last Word with Matt Cooper on Today FM.
Now, our next guest says that medicine is deceitful and corrupt, full of its own self-importance, in love with an unsustainable view of itself as an agent of positive change, and that it peddles lies to patients about their illnesses and their capacity to survive them. It is enthralled to the pharmaceutical industry. Dr. Seamus O'Mahony, thank you very much for joining us. That's a pretty lengthy charge sheet. Very, very serious accusations. Tell me why you make them.
Okay. So I start out by defining what I call the golden period of medicine and of medical research, which was a 50-year period from about the mid-30s to the mid-1980s. So I qualified in 1983 and caught the very end of this golden age. Now, if you look at what was achieved in this age, it is absolutely spectacular. So let's take, for example, tuberculosis, which caused 1 in 10 deaths in Ireland in the 19th century. A treatment was found, a cure was found, streptomycin.
So what was tuberculosis for people who have no idea of what it actually was and what it did to people?
Tuberculosis was a chronic infection which mainly affected the lungs but could affect any organ in the body, caused by a specific bacterium called Mycobacterium tuberculosis. And you've probably seen sanatoria all over this country. In Cork, it was Sarsfields Court, which is now a psychiatric hospital. So there were hospitals all over Ireland dedicated solely to the treatment of tuberculosis.
And how was it eradicated?
Well, it was eradicated by mass immunisation and by the discovery of drugs such as streptomycin in the late 40s and subsequently better drugs in the 50s and 60s. So that's one example of the golden age.
Yeah, because I'm also fascinated by the example. Polio is another thing. The work of Jonas Salk in the United States. And they're coming up with a vaccination. And I've always been interested in this, but when you see the anti-vaxxers around at the moment.
Absolutely.
Who seem to be oblivious to the advances in 20th century healthcare that was brought around by immunizations.
Absolutely. I mean, if you read Patrick Coburn's memoir of his illness.
We interviewed him about that book and telling about his time in Cork dealing with his diagnosis of polio.
So the Cork City was virtually quarantined for a period in the 1950s. So this is a devastating illness, and you still see the survivors around to this day, people who are now in their early 60s with the scars of this disease. Polio has been essentially eradicated, all right? Smallpox is officially eradicated by the WHO have declared it eradicated. So in this golden age, we saw infant mortality drop spectacularly, maternal mortality drop spectacularly, and longevity increased significantly. We can now all expect to live into our eighth or even ninth decades. This golden age saw the discovery of the double helix of DNA. It saw the arrival of CT scanning, MRI scanning, organ transplantation. I could go on. So this was a spectacular period in human history and in medical innovation. So I caught the very end of that when I qualified in the early 80s. But what I've argued is that since then, the gains have been much more modest, far more attritional, and at a huge cost. So although the golden age did give us these undoubted benefits in terms of cure of these diseases, prevention of these diseases, it also created what I've called a medical industrial complex. So when President Eisenhower was standing down as president of the USA, he gave a speech where he warned the Americans against the development of what he called a military industrial complex. We've seen something similar in medicine. This golden age created this medical industrial complex.
You still work inside the system. The reason you're here today is you've got this new book that you've written, Can Medicine Be Cured? The Corruption of a Profession, as you call it. But you're still an active member of this profession as well. You work where and doing what?
Okay, I work in Cork University Hospital. I'm a gastroenterologist and general physician. A gastroenterologist is someone who deals with diseases of the stomach, bowel and liver. When I use the word corruption, I'm not talking about the entire profession. I am talking about certain aspects of it. I've dealt particularly with biomedical research, which I feel, and I'm not the only one here, has gone badly wrong. The editor,
in what way?
Well, put it this way. The editor of The Lancet, Richard Horton, has said something has gone seriously wrong with one of our greatest human creations. So there is a consensus within the medical establishment that medical research has lost its way. There was a symposium, for example, held in London 3 years ago on this very topic. And this brought together bodies like the Wellcome Trust, the Medical Research Council, the Academy of Medical Sciences, all the big players in the establishment of biomedical research. And there was a consensus that a huge amount of medical research is wasted. This is because this research is driven very often by factors other than scientific curiosity. It's driven by commercialization. It's driven by careerism. So scientists are driven by perverse incentives to produce large quantities of relatively poor research.
Because that's where the money is.
That's where the money is in terms of grants, but it's also where the promotion is. So careers in science, and this is not just science, but it's across all sorts of academic endeavours, are based on these kind of metrics, which include how many papers you've published, how much grant money you've brought in, how often these papers are cited by other researchers, and so on. And these can be put together in various indices and metrics which are measurable. But these have had the unintended and perverse incentivization of poor quality research.
Because getting back to what I mentioned earlier with Jonas Salk and the polio vaccine, he developed that while working in a US state-sponsored laboratory. This became something that then was rolled out across the United States and rolled out globally, not because it was done for any commercial gain or by any pharmaceutical company. This was public health.
Correct.
You don't get as much of that anymore, do you? Because everything has been outsourced effectively to the pharmaceutical companies, the biomedical industry, who are looking to come up with drugs that can turn super profits.
Correct. Three quarters of drug trials published in the major medical journals are carried out by the industry, not by government. So back, I talk about tuberculosis. So the first ever trial of streptomycin, which was also the first ever so-called randomized controlled trial, which is now the gold standard for carrying out trials of drugs. This was carried out not by a drug company, but by the Medical Research Council, a government-funded agency in the years immediately after the war. And this proved beyond doubt that streptomycin cured tuberculosis.
But hold on, isn't there an enormous amount of good work going on at present in our universities around Ireland? UCC, for example, as well, cancer research, various other types of medical research been done in all the universities, been done in conjunction with, often funded by the pharmaceutical companies, but the research is been done in our colleges.
There is undoubtedly good research going on. I do not deny that for a moment. But there is a huge amount of bad research also being carried out. And when research is funded by the pharmaceutical industries, or trials are funded by the pharmaceutical industries, they will design those trials to maximise the their own product, to maximise the benefit of their own product. And they often recruit patients who are not typical of the type of patients who may end up using the drug. They recruit younger, fitter patients than the people who often end up taking the medication. They use relatively meaningless endpoints in some of these trials, particularly cancer trials, where they use endpoints like disease-free progression rather than survival. So disease-free progression in a cancer trial, for example, might be that it means that your tumour hasn't got any bigger on a CT scan. Now, they use this as an endpoint. But in real life, this is a completely meaningless endpoint.
But hold on a second. Hasn't cancer survival rates improved dramatically in recent decades? I mean, whereas once, when you got a cancer diagnosis, it was almost a death sentence. Now, isn't there a reasonably good chance for many people that they will actually survive it? Isn't that down to medical advances and drug advances?
Some cancers, yes, that is true for some cancers. But for many cancers, I would take the examples of lung cancer, pancreatic cancer. There has been relatively minimal or no improvement over the past couple of decades. So for a great number of cancers, particularly the common ones, lung and pancreas, for example, there's been very little improvement in overall survival.
Okay, but why is that? Could it be that it just is simply too difficult at present, that we don't have the scientific knowledge, rather than that efforts haven't been made?
Efforts have been made since the early 70s. Richard Nixon famously declared war on cancer in 1971 when he signed the National Cancer Act. The Americans, who had put a man on the moon only a couple of years before, were convinced that they would, you know, lick cancer in time for the bi-millennium celebrations in 1976. That never happened. Cancer is far more complex as a disease than we imagine.
If you just joined us, we're talking to Dr. Seamus O'Mahony, who has written a new book, Can Medicine Be Cured? The Corruption of a Profession. He is a consultant at Cork University Hospital. Your particular area of speciality, Seamus. Tell us a little bit more, though, about the survival rates in that and the drugs that have been made available. Do you find in your time that you've been working in it that it has become easier to treat people?
There have been some spectacular advances. There's no doubt about that. I would take the example of hepatitis C, which is a chronic infection which can now be completely cured. We've seen other modest gains in diseases like Crohn's disease and colitis, but they're relatively modest. We're not seeing the sort of magic bullet cure for any of these things. We've seen HIV turn from a death sentence into a condition that can now be lived with long term, and that's been a great advance. So yes, there have been advances, but compared to the golden age, which I've written about, they're much less spectacular. During the golden age, we, to use the cliche, picked the low-hanging fruit, and the spectacular advances that were achieved in that 50 years, we've not been seeing.
But that's interesting, because one of the things I read at the start of this interview, sort of a synopsis of your book, was about how medicine often peddles lies to patients about their illnesses and their capacity to survive them. Because maybe we give people too much hope in relation to illnesses. Maybe it is because of the human condition, the makeup of the human body. It's not like devising new technologies and Moore's law about increasing the speed at which technologies can be updated. This is far more complex when you're dealing with diseases and illnesses and ailments of the human body.
Yeah, we've in medicine has adopted this Cartesian idea of the body as a complex machine. And I've argued that we are far more than that. And that this model, along with the idea of the magic bullet, isn't really giving us the benefits that we had hoped for or that we've claimed it could bring us.
Okay. But I mean, when you say medicine is deceitful, full of its own self-importance, in love with an unsustainable view of itself as an agent of positive change, tease that out for me a little bit more, because what you're saying to me almost is sort of like get away, is that you can't do all of these things.
No. My friend Richard Smith, who used to be the editor of the British Medical Journal for many years, wrote about the bogus contract between patients and doctors. And this bogus contract is based on doctors and patients, particularly, believing that medicine can cure everything, that doctors can diagnose everything, that they can know everything it's necessary to know, that they can fix all sorts of problems, even social ones. Doctors know that this contract is bogus. They know that their powers are limited. They know that there's a very fine line between doing good and doing harm. They know that they can fix social problems. And I guess I would argue that we need a recalibration of that bogus contract.
Okay, I would argue with you, Seamus, that I would never regard a doctor as infallible. But I'd much prefer to trust a doctor than I would prefer something that I found on an internet search or some quack who's actually trying to tell me that some alternative methods, completely ignoring medicine, doing with lifestyle choices, is somehow going to deal with a serious illness I might have.
Yeah, I am completely in support of that. I've argued in the book that I am completely pro-science. Science is the best way we have of working out how this world works. What I'm arguing against is bad science, poor science, science that has no function other than making money and advancing careers. That's what I've argued against. I've also argued very much against the claims of alternative medicine in the book. So I'm coming from quite a mainstream sort of position.
What about the issue of overprescribing? Because this is something that people are very particularly worried about, given that it also suggested that it may be leading to a decline in the power of antibiotics, that they're becoming perhaps, their effectiveness has been diminished by overuse and overprescribing.
Yeah, there is no doubt that we are heading towards a situation where many common antibiotics may become ineffective and that relatively routine infections may become untreatable. There's very little incentive for the pharmaceutical companies to develop new antibiotics. A course of antibiotics is taken for a week. If you give a drug for dementia, on the other hand, it's taken for years or even decades. So we're heading towards a situation where antibiotic resistance, we're already at the situation where antibiotic resistance is a problem, and it may become much worse than it is already. In terms of overprescribing, that is a recognised problem, particularly in the elderly. We know that a huge proportion of the elderly population are taking several medications, the benefits of which, of many of which, are debatable to say the least, and many of which are actively harmful. So it's reckoned that as many as one in six admissions into hospital in elderly people is due to a drug side effect. So overprescribing is a big problem.
So we prescribe to deal with the consequences of the initial prescription?
Well, they talk about the prescribing cascade. So let's say you're given a drug for high blood pressure. It causes ankle swelling as a side effect. You're given a diuretic to deal with the ankle swelling. The diuretic causes potassium depletion. You're given potassium tablets. The potassium tablets make you nauseated. You're given a drug for nausea. The drug for that makes you confused, and so on and so on and so on. So this is called the prescribing cascade.
Dr. Seamus O'Mahony, saying all these things publicly, does this make you popular or unpopular with your colleagues and peers?
I don't know, Matt. The book is only out a few days.
Yeah, but hang on. Do doctors discuss these issues between yourselves? Or do you sort of work in isolation?
No, we do discuss these issues amongst ourselves. Everything I've said in this book has been said by other people. I'm not the first person to point out that medical research has lost its way. The medical establishment has agreed as much. I'm not the first person to point out that overprescribing in the elderly has become a major problem. So I'm not the first person to point out any of these problems. I think what I've done is to produce a synthesis of these problems in one readable volume, I hope, for the general reader.
Yeah, but what hope do you have, and even expectation, that anything might actually change, that you and others could actually push from within the medical profession to reform it?
I think the first step is to open the debate, to admit that there are problems. That's the very first step, and that's what I'm hoping to achieve here. I don't know how much all of this can be changed. I've conceded in the book that the incentives to continue the current situation are so great that it may not be reformable.
Incentives for the doctors in their dealings with the pharmaceutical industry, or for the dealings of the state as a major provider of healthcare services with pharmaceuticals? Where does the change have to take place?
I think the change has to take place at many levels. I think that the relationship between the medical profession and the pharmaceutical industry is very unhealthy, and that something has to change in that regard. I think that medical research needs to be reformed. I think that evidence-based medicine, which was once the gold standard for how we did things, has been hijacked to a greater or lesser extent by commercial interests, and we need to do something about that. I think many of these issues that I've raised should be part of medical education.
But to finish, Dr. Seamus O'Mahony, people are living longer, so how do you account for that?
Medicine currently in developed countries contributes very little to health. Your health is far more determined by how much you earn, what your education is, and where you live. In developed countries, medicine and contributes to only about 10% in health variation.
When you say health variation, as in the length of time you're likely to live, is it?
Yeah. So, you know, it's health is not down to medicine. Health is a far broader concept than simply going to doctors and taking medications.
It's fascinating stuff. The book is called Can Medicine Be Cured? The Corruption of a Profession. Seamus O'Mahony, thank you very much for taking the time to join us here on The Last Word on Today FM.
The Last Word with Matt Cooper on Today FM.